Let me introduce myself. I'm Andrew Newman at Edinburgh University. I'm the host for this evening's talk, Agreeable News from Persia, by Daniel T. Potts. Let me introduce Daniel Potts. He's professor of ancient Near Eastern archaeology and history at the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World at New York University. His lifelong fascination with and the love of Iranian history and archaeology began with his first visit to Iran in 1973, and has led him to work on a wide range of topics ranging in time from prehistory to the modern period. His most recent books include Persia Portrayed, Envoys to the West 1600 to 1842 from 2022, A Nook in the Temple of Fame, French Military Officers in Persian Service 2023, Agreeable News from Persia, Iran and the Colonial and Early Republican American Press, Springer last year, 2022. He received his AB and his PhD from Harvard University. He's consulting editor for the Encyclopedia Iranica. He's a corresponding member of the German Archaeological Institute and ISMAIO, the Associazione Internazionale di Studi sul Mediterraneo e l'Oriente. I hope I got that reasonably correct. And a corresponding fellow of the British Academy. And so with that, Daniel Potts, the floor or the screen is yours. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much, Andrew, for that kind introduction. The topic, I feel like Monty Python now for something completely different. The topic that I'm going to talk about today is not one that probably most people associate with me. Obviously, Iranology, Iranian studies is a huge field. And there are, I'm sure, people who've tuned in today who work on very different subjects, Timurids, Samanids, who knows. And so you probably don't even know me. If you know me, you probably know that I'm an archaeologist primarily and also work on historical sources relating to ancient Iran. And this is the sort of stuff that I've published and worked on over the course of my academic career. So it's a little, so my topic today obviously comes probably for many of you sort of out of left field or out of the blue. It really goes back to a chance encounter I had, thanks to the beauties of Google, about 6 years ago. I was Googling actually something to do with ancient weaponry. And in the course of using various keywords, one of which must have been saber, I came upon these two small notices published in early in 1873, alleging that the Shah, Nasser al-Din Shah at the time, had sent a sword that had actually been used by Abbas Mirza, Fatali Shah's son and sometime crown prince. The sword had been used during the second Russo-Persian War. And that he did this, Nasser al-Din Shah did this. He sent this sword to the American author Mansfield Tracy Walworth, because Walworth in 1871 had published a novel called Dullaplane, which really focuses very much on the Second Russo-Persian War. And allegedly, according to these press notices, Nasser al-Din Shah was so impressed by the depiction of his ancestor, Abbas Mirza, that he sent him this sword that Abbas Mirza had used as a token of his esteem. Now, if you have never heard of either Walworth or the novel Dullaplane, that is hardly surprising. After seeing those notices, I went and dug up a copy of the book, Dullaplane or the Sacrifice of Irene, as you see here. And there's a nice portrait of Mansfield Tracy Walworth, the author. It's an excruciatingly bad novel, with full of fantasy, in fact. But it actually sold about 50,000 copies early on after its issue. And Walworth, who is entirely forgotten today as an author, you know, knew how to write something that was vaguely popular, and earned him some money. But the real reason that Walworth is known to anybody, and that's still to very few, is because about 6 months after those articles appeared announcing that Nasr al-Din Shah was giving him the saber that had belonged to Abbas Mirza, Mansfield Walworth was shot dead by his son, his 18-year-old son, in New York City. And this was because the son believed, felt very strongly that his father had really abused his mother. And they were both from upstate New York. They were from Utica, New York. And they were both in New York City. And this, according to all of the accounts, of which there are numerous ones, you can see here a book devoted just to the so-called the parricide of Mansfield Tracy Walworth, The Astounding Murder. So according to these accounts, the son went to the hotel where his father was staying in order to shoot him. He found him not in the hotel at the time, left him a note, asked him to come to his hotel. The next day, Walworth came to the hotel and his son shot him dead and promptly walked to the nearest police station to turn himself in. So this was a really notorious case. And for those of you who've ever looked into the weird literature on parricides, this immediately featured in late 19th, early 20th century books on parricide as such a notorious example. Eventually, there was a big trial, and the young Walworth, Frank Walworth, was sentenced to prison, to life in prison. But he was then later pardoned by the governor of New York. So that's Walworth. But looking at the book, I was struck by a number of things. I was struck by really detailed passages about Iran. And so here is one on the left that you see, the white one, where Walworth is saying that the Morghab plain or valley and ruins, which is Pisargadi, have been described thus by a famous English traveler. And then there's a long, long quotation which runs over several pages. And as you can see on the right, that quotation is lifted wholesale from Sir Robert Kerr Porter's famous work on his travels, published in 1821. But it was more the fact that, as the articles alleged that Nasr al-Din Shah was so impressed by the depiction of Abbas Mirza, it's true. When you're reading this very, very sort of trashy novel, suddenly you come upon passages that give great detail about the political context of the Second Russo-Persian War and about individual battles. So I began to wonder what sources did he have at his disposal. Obviously, we've just seen a long quotation lifted from Sir Robert Kerr Porter. Here is an annual news sort of digest known as the Annual Register for 1826. Bearing in mind, this is over 50 years before Walworth wrote his book. But you can see that the passage that you see on the left in Dilla Plain is lifted right out of the Annual Register here. So he had access to things like the Annual Register. He had obviously access to travel works by Europeans that reached the United States and were sold here by booksellers. But also what was fascinating to see, once I began to really dig more deeply into it, is the fact that the newspapers of the time of the Second Russo-Persian War were full of detailed accounts of exactly what was going on. Now, it's not for a moment to suggest that there were reporters from the American colonies or the early United States who were out there. As you can see, the report on the right here, this long report, is taken from the Journal of St. Petersburg. So this is an official Russian government account of goings-on in the war. But then there are many, many other articles, literally hundreds of articles, giving all kinds of levels of detail of troop movements, of battles, naming the commanders, talking about casualties, et cetera, et cetera. And I began to, because I began with De La Plaine, the setting of the book in the Second Russo-Persian War, I started with that. But then I got interested in the question of just generally, was this an unusual phenomenon? Or was news of current events in American newspapers, current events in Iran, being represented in American newspapers routinely? And so I pushed my searching back really to the beginnings of the very first newspapers in the American colonies that contain any news bulletins about contemporary events in Iran or Iran-related material. And lo and behold, the result is this work, which was mentioned earlier by Andrew, and from which I take the title for today's talk, Agreeable News from Persia. Effectively, I combed through the use of databases of digitized American newspapers. I was able to amass a very formidable collection of news accounts relating to contemporary events in Iran. I went right back to 1712, which was the date of the earliest article I found that concerned Iran. And then I cut it off with the death of, I went a little past the Second Russo-Persian War, as you can see, by 20 years, and I cut it off with the death of Muhammad Shah for a number of reasons. First of all, once you get to the reign of Nasruddin Shah, there is a lot more news in the European and American press. Also, in the 1860s, you start to have the introduction of news transmission by telegraph, and that then leads to an explosion of international news. But there are a couple of general points which are of interest. One is the fact that when American scholars write about early colonial newspapers and the newspapers of the United States after the American Revolution, they always talk about the role of these newspapers in providing a venue or helping to solidify, to form and to solidify a sense of American identity. And this becomes particularly important after the American Revolution with the Federalist Papers and the whole notion of federal states versus states' rights versus the central government and so forth. What they never ever talk about is the immense quantity of international news. And I'm only dealing with obviously the Iranian related portion of that international news. But these newspapers going right back to the early colonial days are simply full of international news. And it's interesting to note that at the outbreak of the American Revolution, 1776, there were only about three dozen newspapers in the 13 American colonies. 50 years later, there were over 1,300, and they all needed content. Now, where they got content before the days of the telegraph is extremely interesting, and it's also very transparent, because many of these articles begin by saying something along the lines, through the good offices of Captain Jones, who has just arrived from Liverpool, we have English and continental newspapers up to August 10th, let's say. He's arrived in November, and he's got newspapers with him, and he's got some kind of a relationship. These ship's captains had relationships with specific newspaper editors in the ports into which they came, so New York, Boston, and further south. They gave them the European and not just British, but also European newspapers. And then these articles, which had already appeared months earlier, were simply taken and transcribed and reproduced, so that news of the world was really being disseminated all the time in the American press. Yes, it was dated by a couple of months, sometimes by about 6 months, but it was there. And of course, also you have the problem that sometimes a certain account is published which precedes an older account, let's say from a week earlier, that another editor got hold of. So you have a real a kind of a problem. It's very easy to see. And the newspaper editors would often then, while they didn't normally editorialize, and they really did tend to lift the content entirely from the European or the British newspaper source, they sometimes do editorialize, and they'll, recognizing that, you know, a bulletin they'd published yesterday said there were 5,000 casualties on the Ottoman side, and the bulletin they published today said, no, it was actually an Ottoman victory, and there were 5,000 casualties on the Persian side. They'll say the news is simply too inconclusive for us to know what is right, what is correct. But eventually, obviously, as the reports keep coming in, readers, and not just the editors, but the readers would be able to see for themselves where there was simply an error. Now, those errors could be disinformation, as they often were. Abbas Mirza was not averse, for example, to telling his father, Fatali Shah, that they'd had a great victory when they'd actually had a defeat. The Ottoman Sultan was not averse to telling the population in Constantinople that they'd had a great victory when, in fact, they'd also just been defeated. Now, the upshot of this is to say that in taking my inquiries back to 1712 and cutting them off at 1848, I collected over 2,500 articles from about 650 newspapers, which are scattered far and wide. As you can see here, just from one page of the list of newspapers that I excerpted, they're from all over the place, from the south, from Georgia, all the way up to Maine. There are some real problems, of course, for a 20th, 21st century reader, as there were problems for contemporary readers. As you would imagine, and knowing something about transliteration of Persian names, toponyms, anthroponyms, there's a lot of mangling of phonetically trying to write technical terms, like you see titles here on the right, or personal names that you see here on the left. And so I had, you know, my job was not to just collect these articles, obviously, but also to explicate them and make this useful and make it clear. But you can just see, you can pull out many, many examples, but how Kaimakam becomes completely corrupted in Kaimakan, and the list goes on, Elmata Daula instead of Itamar al-Daula, etc. Same with ethnonyms, different ethnic groups, tribal groups that are mentioned. And of course, toponyms are also really mangled. And so I did my best to try to identify exactly what places are being mentioned in all kinds of variant spellings. And of course, the German newspapers or the Russian newspapers have different transliteration than the English newspapers or the French newspapers. So just briefly and quickly to show you, this survey begins in the reign of Shah Sultan Hussein, prior to the real crisis period, 1720s, early 1720s, with the downfall of the Safavid dynasty. What I've done in the book is to reproduce in chronological order of appearance in American newspapers the articles that really deal with contemporary news events. And I've pulled out then what I call miscellaneous articles that are more cultural and sort of not part of the stream of history, so to speak. So for example, you can see that there's a notice about the death of Jean Chardin or an article about the provision of wells or the death of an English physician in Isfahan, things like that, or an earthquake. And we go from the fall of the Safavids through the Afghan sort of interregnum period to the rise of Nader Shah, his career, his last years, tons of reporting on all of this, to the end of Nader Shah's reign and the civil war, the coming of the consolidation of by the Zands, the coming of Agha Muhammad Shah and the foundation of the Qajar dynasty. And along the way, you can see there are many random, in the miscellaneous articles are also extremely interesting sometimes, and they are also often anachronistic. And one wonders, these newspapers in America tended to be printed at a very, very small typeface, and they were packed with news. And this kind of news, these Iranian stories are all over the place. They're not relegated to the back page by any means. But there was probably also a certain sense in which they really needed to fill their pages. And therefore, there is anachronistic content constantly. So here we are 40 years after Nader Shah's death, and there's a little notice about his tent or about the booty that he took when he conquered the Mughal Empire. And this sort of thing is really not uncommon. Here's an excerpt of from Pietro della Valle that's simply inserted into the papers in the first decade or two of the 19th century. And so you can see here the first Russo-Persian War, Fath Ali Shah's reign, the first Russo-Persian War, the Turco-Persian War are covered in great detail, but also, you know, you've got the Reverend Henry Martin, you've got James Justinian Morier, you've got Rasmus Rask, the Danish Orientalist, all kinds of content, Sir John Malcolm's uniform, all kinds of content, Sir William Ousley's manuscript collection. And then we have the second Russo-Persian War, which is where I began. You have the murder of Griboyedov. After that, you come up to the death of Fath Ali Shah, a little bit of a struggle to get Muhammad Shah on the throne. The whole Herat issue, which ultimately led to the Anglo-Persian War of 1857, but this is earlier in time, and this led to a real crisis in Anglo-Persian relations. You also have a lot, which I've pulled out to keep together, a lot about the American Presbyterian missionaries who started their mission at Urmia in the 1830s. And then you have I cut it off, as you can see, with the accession of Nasser al-Din Shah. And along the way, much of sort of random miscellaneous character, which you simply don't find normally in historical works, contemporary historical works about, let's say, the early Qajar period. A Yankee cooking stove that was sent to Muhammad Shah and was put together by a couple of the people from the mission because they knew how these things worked. Or the scourge of New England rum that the American missionaries were appalled to see entering Iran in the 1830s and 40s. So there is just a huge amount of fascinating material, which, you know, to my mind has been not intentionally ignored, but it has been omitted and overlooked by scholars. And really, there's a remarkable amount of detail on all these developments that I've just quickly talked about, from the fall of the Safavids, Shah Sultan Hussein. Here's an example talking about putting all the princes to death except for Tahmasp, or Peter the Great's expedition into the Caucasus, which led to the loss of Dagestan, Georgia, and Armenia from the Persian realm. Here you have the Ottoman treaty with the Afghans with Sultan Ashraf on the front page of the American Weekly Mercury, which was one of the main newspapers. It was published in Boston. So this is not relegated. This is right up there on the front page, next to some news from Warsaw, again, showing that in this, even in this early period, 1728, there's a huge amount of content from the outside world. And especially, I mean, for my interest, especially relating to Iran and the Middle East. Nader Shah, as I mentioned before, is fully covered his entire career. The Civil War is fully covered. The names become extremely confusing. And we know this also from works like John Perry's on Karim Khan Zand, that there are many contenders for power. They're all there in the American newspapers. Many, many notices of earthquakes as we move through these this century and a half or so, with dates, which is also quite important. The rise of the Qajars, or here you see also, often there are errors in the reporting. Here you see something about wanting to put Shah Nader on the throne, the Russians wanting to do this at the time that Aga Muhammad Shah was becoming powerful. So they've simply clearly gotten the names wrong here. Askar Khan's embassy to Paris, Askar Khan, the ambassador sent by Fath Ali Shah to Napoleon, that's fully covered. The Gardan mission, Napoleon's diplomatic mission with military advisors to Fath Ali Shah, that's also fully covered in the papers. Mirza Abul Hassan Khan's two embassies to Britain is also covered in great detail. A lot about his social life in London and parties he went to, balls he went to, people whom he met. His second visit as well of 1819. As I said before, the murder of Griboyedov is fully covered, and it was clearly a sensation, as you see in the titles, assassination of a Russian minister. It was in all the newspapers. And then the mission of apology, Khosrow Mirza, the son of Abbas Mirza, who went to apologize to Nicholas I for the murder of Griboyedov and his suite. The American mission I mentioned, and also the visit in 1842 of the Bishop Mar Yohanan, Bishop of Vormia, together with Justin Perkins and his family. So again, while he was in America, that was a very kind of covered extensively in the press. And so that is really the story. This sort of journey down a very big rabbit hole of American news coverage that is published in Agreeable News from Persia led also to these other two books, Persia Portrayed and A Nook in the Temple of Fame, which is all of which is very far from, obviously, from my earlier and original archaeological work. But my feeling is the more I know about Iran in all periods, the better I'm able to deal with any individual period, whether it's archaeological or historical. So thank you very much, and I look forward to your questions.
That was absolutely fascinating. Yeah, absolutely fascinating. Thank you very, very much. I exercise a quick question to just say I'm originally from Philadelphia, and I wonder if you know if there are any things there from the Philadelphia.
Absolutely.
There we go. Very good to hear. Very good. I'm sure that the Philadelphia papers were much better, and all those other things come from the other newspapers. I already have some questions here. Let me just make sure I get to them. Yeah, I've got some, so I will not ask any of my own questions again. In your literature review, did you get much reference to the opium trade? Was it a popular or rare theme for any of these articles?
No, it's mentioned, and I should say that there is, I didn't mention, but there's a huge amount of reference to the East India Company and its involvement commercially and politically. Opium doesn't feature. Tobacco absolutely features. And there was
the same questioner notes that. Yes, that's right. Yeah,
there was a great interest actually in introducing Persian tobacco into America. And Willem Flohr has written a lot about tobacco, and there's a great there's a lot of interesting work on exactly where the tobacco came from that was recognized as Persian tobacco because it was very strong. But opium, no, opium is not really a big mentioned much. Thinking of the miscellaneous articles, I can look at my index, but I don't remember opium really.
Okay, thank you very much. In what way did the choice of news shared with U.S. readers regarding events in Persia and beyond change after the American Revolution in the later 1770s, 1782?
Well, I guess, as I mentioned before, there was an explosion in the number of newspapers. So you literally went from three dozen in 1776 to 1,300 or so 50 years later. And so the diffusion of the news was much, much more widespread. I think I have newspapers up to 1848 that are as far west as Wisconsin and down to New Orleans, over to Georgia, all the way up to Maine, up to upstate New York. So you could say that, and I think with events like the two Russo-Persian wars, they really were very closely covered. Now, I can't say, as I said before, as I tried to describe, that this news was being lifted from newspapers that were coming from the continent and from Britain, even from India, from British India sometimes. I don't get the feeling that there was a huge amount of discrimination. I kind of felt that to the extent that they printed very tiny, used a very tiny font and had newspapers that were packed with news, they dumped everything in that was international. So it's not as though they were favoring in any way the news from Persia, because, you know, you can equally find right next to it who the Duchess of Mecklenburg had lunch with last month, right? Everything is in there from the European courts. It's really remarkable. But I guess I would just say that the diffusion had to have meant that there was a greater and an increasing awareness of the Qajar empire and of course the Qajars in contention with the Russians and the Ottoman Empire. That was very big. The rise of Wahhabism is covered in as well. So events in the Arabian Peninsula and Syria and Egypt are covered. And then, as I said, lots of coverage of East India Company links with Iran, the embassy of Sir Harford Jones, Sir John Malcolm, all of that is covered. Bushehr's role as a port, piracy in the Persian Gulf. There's, you know, it's all in there.
Daniel, may I thank you very, very much. It's absolutely fascinating discussion. Absolutely terrific, and glad to know that Philadelphia, you know, made its mark even in those days. I thank all the participants. We had a very large number of people. Daniel, once again, thank you so very much. That was absolutely terrific. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot.
You all to everyone. And to you, Daniel, good morning. And to people here in the UK and to the East, good evening and thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.